this is a church? He really made a mess of this place. The funny thing is how it all got this way. You know, earlier today, before church started, there were all these people here, right? Well, they're coming in, they're buying and selling stuff, and, you know, I never really paid it much mind, because that's just the way it's always been. You come to church, and people are trying to sell you something. Well, today, this guy comes in, and he looks around, and he sees people buying and selling stuff, and he just goes nuts. He's like, what are you people doing here? Don't you know this is a church, not a place of business? He starts knocking tables over, pushing chairs down. Money and stuff is scattered everywhere. The people are freaking out. They're like, I'm just coming to church, minding my own business. And this guy is trashing the place. Well, the priests or the church leaders or whatever, they are ticked off. And you can really tell they want to kill this guy. But he doesn't pay him any mind. He just continues trashing this place and running everybody out of here. Well, that's why I'm here. I get to clean up. But, you know, I never saw anything like that before. I mean, I never saw anything like that before.
You know, if you go to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, see a rather strange book that they have on display. You might call it the Jefferson Bible. It's a leather-bound book that was Thomas Jefferson's that he created. Apparently what he did was he went into his Bible and he took a pair of scissors and he cut out all of the references to any miracles that Jesus did or anything supernatural because he didn't like that stuff. So he cut all those out and then he took what was left and he pasted that into his own version of the Bible. Now, you know, because I guess he liked the teaching, he liked the wisdom of Jesus' teaching, but he didn't like wrestling with what it meant to, you know, these miracles and this supernatural stuff. So this kind of image of Jesus as somebody who was just this kind of wise teacher was a much more palatable picture of Jesus for Jefferson to handle. Now, if you ask me, the idea of going into your Bible with a pair of scissors and taking the time to cut all that out, that's just as strange as some of the stuff that he ended up cutting out of his Bible, you know, in the first place. You know, I think that's a place that we can find ourselves on our journey, if we're not careful. This kind of, we want to be on a journey where we're asking questions and, you know, is there a God and what's the meaning of life and that kind of stuff. But at the same time, we want all of our answers, we want everything to fit really nicely into the rows and columns of our spiritual spreadsheet in a way we can always perfectly understand. Now, I'm not saying that reason and logic do not need to be a key part of our faith. Absolutely. I'm not talking about committing intellectual suicide to embrace our faith. We have questions. We have real questions about our faith. We need to take those seriously, and we need to be on a journey where we search for answers. You know, maybe it's questions like, well, can reason and faith coexist in the first place? You know, or is the Bible true, or is it just a bunch of myths, you know, and kind of political spin that's happened over time? Or is there any evidence that Jesus was who he said he was? You know, that kind of stuff. We need to take our questions like that seriously. But at the same time, we need to be careful. We need to be careful that in our quest for faith, we are making room for mystery. We're building in room for maybe not having all the answers perfectly nailed down. I mean, think about it. If there is a God, what do you think the chances are that the words mystery and wonder and awe fit so much more appropriately than understandable and safe? We need to keep room for the mystery. I mean, look around you, even in nature, for example. I mean, we're told that from what science knows is that as humans, we can only see about 30% of the light spectrum that exists. So, for example, there's animals such as bees that can actually detect ultraviolet light and respond to it that we can't see. I think it's the same in spiritual things as it is in the natural world. I think there are parts of the spectrum that we will never see on this earth, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. We need to take our questions seriously and wrestle for answers, but at the same time, we need to make sure that when we're thinking about things like God, that we leave room for mystery. We leave room for the possibility that there is such a thing as this finite being, as this infinite being, that possibly our finite minds cannot comprehend everything there is about them. There is certainly a place for answers, but there's a place for mystery. There's a place for the natural, and there's a place for the supernatural.
Okay, so there's this guy. This real crazy Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Kaczynski type of guy. And he was in trouble with the law, been in and out of institutions, in trouble with the law, in trouble with everybody. And he would haul off in this graveyard somewhere, and he would do things to himself, like real scary type movie things to himself, like self-mutilation, things like that. And for a while, nobody knew where he was. And there was this preacher guy, this guy who wandered throughout the countryside delivering, well, preaching. And he was walking through the woods, and he came upon this man, this crazy man. And he sat down with him, and he started praying. And as he started praying, the crazy man looked like he was about to jump the guy. And he's saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? Don't hurt me. I'm thinking, what is this? Don't hurt me? Is he crazy? Well, I know he's crazy, but is he stupid? And the whole time he just keeps getting more and more worried, upset. And this man doesn't budge. He's not afraid. And as he keeps praying with him, the man starts to calm down, actually. Becomes docile. And let me tell you about where we were. We were out on this farm, and there were all these pigs around, eating, I don't know, doing pig things. And as he started to calm down, the pigs started getting more upset. They started acting crazy. They started running around and, like, screaming, and finally they just run off. They run off, and they run off into this lake, and they drown. And the man, the preacher guy, he told the crazy man, who wasn't really crazy anymore, he told him that he was possessed by a demon. I don't know. I don't know if I believe in all this demon possession stuff. But I do know that after he got done praying with the man, he seemed rather calm and normal. I mean, right as rain. Well, word of this started to get out through town. And people started to find out about this preacher man and what he did to save this crazy guy who wasn't really crazy anymore. And they all started to get a little bit upset, worried. They seemed scared. And they started to turn into this giant, scared mob. And they started to, and they chased this preacher out of town. And I don't know if I believe in this demon possession thing, but it seemed like the demons were transferred out of this man and into these pigs. And all I know is that there are some things out there that are unexplainable. Some things that just can't be explained.
I think there's a challenge on our journey that even goes beyond making room for mystery, coming to grips with the fact that our finite minds may not be able to understand everything. I think it goes beyond making room for mystery, that it goes to places of making room for truth that might be uncomfortable. I read an interview with a Wall Street analyst a couple years ago, and he had been particularly successful versus his peer group at accurately predicting the value of new ventures that were coming on the market and established companies. And the journalist was asking him, saying, you know, well, what is your secret? How do you have such a better track record at determining the market value of these companies that are issuing IPOs? How do you do it? And he said what he thought was the answer. He said he thinks he understood how his other peers, the other Wall Street analysts, would come to grips with valuating a company. And what they would do is, based on all their experience, they would have a theory about how much that company was worth. And then what they would do is they would work really hard, gather all the data, get all the numbers they could, do a bunch of interviews, gather all that information to see whether it lined up with their theory or not, to find all this information that supported their theory, and then come to the conclusion of what that company was valued. He said he went at it almost in an opposite way. He said, based on all his experience, he did come to a theory of what that company was worth. Then what he would do is he would work really hard to gather all the information, all the data, all the numbers, do all the interviews, based on trying to find information that proved his theory wrong. He called it looking for disconfirming information. And he said that's what he felt separated his analysis from a lot of his competitors. He said because with his competitors, they would go in pretty much only looking for information that confirmed their theory or not. And it would often cloud their judgment. And he felt he came to a more accurate, truthful understanding of the worth of the company because he focused his efforts on looking for information that would disconfirm his going-in thoughts. I think there's learning there for us as well in life. Because I think the natural default we can slip to is that we subtly in life start to only let truth into our life that tells us what we already believe. We only let things into our life to fall even within the definition of truth that is comfortable for us. We will only consider information that tells us that we're okay. We'll only consider information that tells us that we don't really need to change. Somewhere along the line, we start for only searching for truth that is comfortable. And for comfortable truth is not an honest search for truth. Because we have to realize that there is this true aspect of encountering truth in life. Not always, but often. There's this aspect of encountering truth that is painful. Especially when we're looking for truth about ourselves. Often we will find that it comes to us in uncomfortable ways. That a lot of the truth we uncover about ourselves is not necessarily comfortable. That if we are going to live in a place of growth in our life, not just be somebody who grows every once in a while, but if we are going to live in a place of growth, we've got to get used to regular doses of uncomfortable truth in our life. I had one of those uncomfortable little experiences this week. It was Monday morning, and we were having our programming meeting, where the first thing we were doing was just kind of debriefing, hey, how did the last weekend go? What did we learn? And we were just kind of spending some time sitting around kind of celebrating a lot of the stories we had heard from people about last week's service and the kind of journey that they've been on and the things God had really been doing in people's hearts that kind of culminated with that opportunity last weekend to write what you felt your idols were on that glass ball and come down here and smash it into the coffin just as kind of like a symbolic thing that says, I want to die to myself. I want to get beyond these idols. And we were just sharing all these stories we'd heard from people about what a profound symbolic experience that was for people in their journey. So we spent some time doing that, and then we moved into the part of the meeting where we were then talking about, okay, now let's nail down the final details for this coming weekend, the weekend that we're in right now. And it became fairly obvious from a couple statements pretty early in the meeting that a lot of the logistical details and the extra work that was needed to pull that off with the glass balls and everything last weekend had required more attention to be put to that than normal. And so that now we were not quite as nailed down for this upcoming weekend service as we normally would be. As a matter of fact, some of the things that we were planning to do as part of this service, we might not be able to do because of some of those choices that were made. And I was thinking, okay, well, that's life. These things happen. I need to kind of recalibrate my thinking about, kind of what I'm going to be doing this next weekend at the service. But, we'll deal with that. Went through the rest of the day of meetings and went home that night. And I was kind of thinking through a little bit more detail of kind of, okay, well, where are we going to go with, what we're doing for next week's service? And all these little nasties started to creep into my head. All these kind of little thoughts of, well, why did we make those choices last week? Why couldn't we have done that and do what we need to do this weekend? I mean, why was that a trade-off that we accepted up front that, we're not going to bring our A game next weekend? And are we not going to kind of be able to communicate in the way that we had planned for next weekend because of these choices? And why this weekend? Why did this have to happen? And I started to feel all this kind of bitterness. And what is this going to mean for my week and the way I need to think about this? It felt like all this stuff kind of creep in. And the next morning, Tuesday morning, we have our weekly staff prayer meeting where we all get together as a staff and we spend a little bit of time praying. And kind of the focus of our prayers that morning was, what does this thing called dying to ourself really mean? What does it really mean for us individually? And we were praying about that, and right in the middle of the staff prayer, when we were all sitting around, I just felt this kind of really clear, kind of convicting truth from God kind of settle into my head and then into my heart. And it wasn't really pleasant. And it was, Brian, you're not so much concerned that we're not going to be able to do exactly kind of what we planned for this weekend, and maybe this weekend's not going to come off exactly how we thought about it. You are concerned that we're not going to be able to do exactly what we planned this weekend, and this weekend isn't really going to come off the way we originally thought about it, and you're the one that's speaking. Brian, this is about you, isn't it? Now, that's one of those little kind of whispers of truth to God that I would liken to a kick in the crotch, for instance. And I sat there, and I just felt like, how many times, because of the nature of the role of what I do for a living now, how many times am I able to wrap it in God language and think that I'm doing this for God because I'm doing this for the church, I'm doing this for God, and really, I'm doing it for myself? And how many times do we do that? That was not comfortable truth. That was not pleasant kind of affirming, I'm okay, you're okay kind of stuff. I was trying to think, well, what do I do about this? And a prayer got over, and I was just kind of thinking about that, and I wasn't sure quite what to do, and I just found myself, I walked into the dark auditorium, which obviously, no one was in there. And I walked down here, and we still had the coffins in here from last week. They hadn't been taken out of here yet. And I sat down, and I was just praying and thinking about, boy, how much do I make this about myself? And I found one of the glass balls that hadn't been written on, hadn't been used last weekend. And I just sat there, and I just wrote me. I took it over, and I was able to pry open a corner, a part of the coffin that had been nailed down, and I threw it in there, and I smashed it. Said, I do not want this to be about me. That was not comfortable truth to come to grips with myself. And I don't pretend that I've totally come to grips with it and like I'm past it by any means. I'm sure it's going to come up again and again and again. And it's never comfortable. And I was thinking about it afterwards. I thought, somehow also go public with this. I need to share this with somebody, this kind of nasty things that I'm wrestling with. So I said, I should go tell Brian. And I was thinking about it. And I was like, not easy. You know, I'm going to walk in my boss's office, you know, and I'm going to share with him all this, you know, nasty kind of egotistical stuff that I've been wrestling with, and it partly has to do with him, you know, and I'm going to, you know, come in and do that. Not necessarily entirely comfortable. So, you know, I decided to go in and do that. And, you know, there's some times where, you know, God convicts us of these things and it leads us to share it with somebody. And it's just a really safe place in a relationship that we've invested in over the years. And it just becomes a really healthy thing because it's a safe place to share this ugly stuff with somebody else. And I felt that with Brian. And I did that. And he kind of put his arm on my shoulder and he looked at me and he said, wow, glad I'm not talking this weekend. You know, good luck with it. And not exactly how it came out, but, if we're going to live in a place of growth, we cannot define truth as only things that are comfortable to hear, especially about ourselves. You know, we see in the Bible often talks about this language of God. It talks about God as our Father, you know, our Father in heaven. And a lot of times I think that we can take that definition and do some pretty twisted things with it. You know, start to think, well, if God is my Father in heaven, then he must only want me to be happy. You know, he must only want, you know, kind of, you know, good, comfortable things for me. And we start to go along the ways of, I think C.S. Lewis summed it up well when he said, a lot of us, we're not so much looking to connect with our Father in heaven. We're more looking to connect with our grandfather in heaven. You know, this kind of jovial, slightly senile, you know, old guy that we kind of go to and visit every once in a while and doesn't really need to discipline us or anything. And, you know, and if we make a mess of things, at least when he can leave, he can say, oh, but at least the kids had a good time. And we kind of look for this grandfather in heaven. What we have to come to grips with in increasing consistent ways in our journeys is that to encounter truth is not always comfortable.
This man comes up to me. He asks me for a drink of water. Catches me off guard a bit. It's a little weird. Normally where I come from, people like himself don't want much to do with someone like me. But you know how it is. People come up to you all the time. They want something. They want to sell you their product. They want money. Whatever. I didn't know who he was or what he wanted, so I, you know, attempted to say something and walk away. But he comes after me. Chases me down a bit. He says, you know, did I know who God was and all that? I'm like, okay. And I see where this is going. It's one of those religious wackos you hear about. You know, one of those people have nothing better to do than to interrogate others and be concerned for their soul. But for some stupid reason, I just stood there. He went on to say that if I knew who he was, if I knew who God was, that I would, you know, have this living water and this eternal life. I'm like, okay. All right then. Why don't you give me some? You know, why don't you give me some of that living water? Then he says, go get your husband. You know, and I say, I don't have a husband. He says, you're right. You don't have a husband. Then he looks me directly in the eye and says, the fact is that you've had 5 husbands. And the man that you're with now, he isn't your husband, is he? You know, so now I'm mad. First of all, who does this guy think he is? And second of all, where did he get any of this information? You know, how did he know this about me? You'd think I'd walk away, right? You know, say some choice words and be done with him. But I couldn't. All I could do was stand there and take it. I just didn't know what was going on. You know, inside of me, I felt this concern, this embarrassment, and I didn't know what to say. There was something in the way that he spoke to me, though. I felt this shame, and yet at the same time, I felt this relief, you know. For the first time in my life, all the stuff that I'd been keeping inside of me, it was out in the open. So I asked, you know, are you God? You wouldn't believe what he had to say to that.
Well, one of the things that made Jesus such a public enemy, those that are around him, was the fact that he often spoke direct, hard truth to somebody. But he didn't do it in kind of an attacking way. One of the things that made him public enemy was the mystery about some of the things that he did that, quite frankly, it scared people. But I think our journeys with wrestling with who he was and what that means to our life goes kind of beyond that as well. Goes beyond this to this thing of growth versus looking like we're growing, which sometimes those two don't move in the same direction. It was about 4 years ago now, I faced the ultimate high-stakes parenting challenge. Now, it wasn't that I needed to help one of my children overcome some ingrained, really bad, destructive habit. You know, it wasn't that I needed to help them learn how to deal with disappointment, something like that. It went much deeper than that, much more profound than that, and the stakes were much higher than that. I needed to prepare my 3-year-old to be ring bearer in a friend's wedding. intense. Now, those of you that don't have kids, you might not be able to appreciate the intensity of this endeavor. Let me just explain it for you, okay? You think the wedding, you know, it's all about, you know, getting together and we're celebrating as a family and all that. And oh, by the way, there's this cute little boy and girl, you know, coming down the aisle. It is not. That whole thing is just simply a big fat public test of the ring bearer's family's parenting skills. The whole thing is, it's basically the family and friends all get together, they all dress up really nice, they come together, they all sit down, they say, okay, you've had the kid for 3 or 4 years now, let's see what you got, you know? And so there's a little bit of pressure. You know, can they execute? And you know, in theory, you know, it shouldn't be a problem, right? I mean, you could put the kid in a nice suit, you give him a little pillow, you have him walk down the aisle, you crank up the camcorder, and you're off to the races. You know, that's basically the way it is. All you basically need to do is have your 3-year-old boy, you know, just have to make sure that they listen to you, you know, and then do what you say. And, you know, then that's it. Now, there's a little bit of curveball in this, though, and you parents know what it is. It's just this little truth that in the history of the world, no 3-year-old boy has ever listened to anyone or did what they said. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. So I'm feeling, you know, this kind of immense stress, you know, of what do we do about this? And, you know, I start to think about it though after a couple of days and this would be wonderful to do. This would be a fun thing to do. And quite frankly, we're not the first parents to have to go through this, you know, and we've all been to weddings where cute things happen with the kids and they don't do it exactly right. You know, we could just, you know, so we could do one of two things about this. We could get like kind of all stressed out about, you know, kind of him doing it perfectly, or we could just kind of relax and enjoy it, you know? I went with the stressed out option on this one. I just felt like the right thing to do, you know. So I decided I was going to pound it into his cute little 3-year-old head, you know, how to walk down the aisle carrying the little pillow, you know, kind of thing. So I did it through, you know, a lot of very overt training exercises that we had executed in the backyard. There will be parts of humor, and I will cue you for that. That was and I also would do it through some more subtle ways. I would I used to make up stories and tell it to him at bedtime, you know, make up these adventurous stories. Well, I replaced those stories with these new ones I would make up that I called the Great Wedding Adventure, you know, that I would tell him. And after a couple of weeks, he got pretty sick of this because no matter how the story started out with dragons or knights or, you know, whatever that would be, it would all culminate with the hero being, you know, the courageous ring bearer carrying the pillow down the aisle, you know, without pulling his pants down or kicking the flower girl, you know, and that was kind of the big, and he got a little old, and after about a month of this training kind of stuff, I started to really kind of look inside a little bit. I think it was in a conversation with Nancy that it first kind of came out. I was thinking, no, I don't really care whether John learns anything or grows in this. You know, I don't really care whether he enjoys this. I care with how am I going to look as a dad. I care with how are we going to look in this, you know, and I should say I was also performing this wedding ceremony, so it was going to be, you know, that if the ring bearer, you know, kind of screwed up, then, you know, the big lazy dad standing right there in front of everybody, you know, kind of watching. I was caring, how are we going to look? Not so much, is there any, you know, is he growing or learning or are we enjoying it? You know, I cared, how do we look in this? And once I kind of came to grips with that, it made the remaining months before that wedding so much easier because we just said, you know what? We're just going to relax and we're going to enjoy this for what this is. It's a time to get together with our friends and celebrate their wedding. It would be a lot of fun. And you know what? When we did that, when we kind of cranked back and we kind of relaxed, I think that's what led John to perform perfectly that day. I think it was the fact that we kind of relaxed and kind of just kind of let go a little bit, that he did his job, you know, absolutely perfect that day. That and maybe the G.I. Joe rocket launcher I bribed him with 10 minutes in the parking lot right before the wedding. You know, see this, John? You do your job. You don't. It goes away, and I put it back in the trunk. And then, little tip. It was for his growth, though. It was a long-term kind of. He did great, and he got the rocket launcher, okay? I had to really realize, like so many times in my life, more times than I'm comfortable admitting up here, I was more about the way we looked than anything else. My primary concern was how are we going to look? And I think that's a place we can slide into so easily. How are we looking? And so our lives become less about growth than am I appearing to grow? Less about growth than am I looking like I'm growing? Less about getting better than getting better at faking it. And one of the things we start to do that can get really deadly in this is we start to choose our friends around us by a similar kind of definition. We start to kind of draw people around us who are also doing really well at faking it and not kind of admitting some of the uglies that they have in their life, but living at a place where they can kind of just fake it and pretend. And those are that we hang out with. You know, one of the things that I think made Jesus such a public enemy to so many at the time, was that he reserved his harshest words not for people that were caught in some big, ugly sin, not for people who had made these terrible kind of mistakes and choices in their life, and it was so obvious. Jesus reserved his harshest words in the Bible, maybe his only what you might consider harsh by some definition words, for people who looked clean but were faking it. For people who were going through all the motions but were pretending. And the flip side of that was that the people that Jesus did hang out with were the people that wouldn't make it on any of our lists.
So I meet this man once, and he was at the home of a friend of mine. And my friend, he was in the tax business. And he had what some people might consider questionable business ethics and practices. You know what I mean? I mean, he was, how would I describe this guy? I mean, my friend, he was a liar. He was a cheat. This guy, I mean, he was a thief. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, he was a friend of mine, and, you know, he threw great parties, you know, and he treated his friends fantastic. I will say that about him. But anyway, we're at this party one night, and he introduces me to this guy. And apparently this guy was some sort of priest or something like that. And he was really challenging my friend to face up to some of the things that he was doing in his life. And it must have worked. I mean, my friend, he started walking around everywhere talking about this guy. He talked about going to work and coming clean, asking forgiveness. And get this, he even started talking about paying people back in ways that he ripped them off. I was floored. I couldn't believe that this was my friend. I was like, he was talking silly or something. I mean, this guy must have been something else to have that kind of effect on people, much less somebody like my friend. So you can imagine my surprise when I go and I meet this guy, and he turns out to be this totally normal, everyday kind of guy. I mean, he was a priest and or something like that. I mean, he talked about God. But it wasn't in this, you guys know what I'm talking about, this like really religious, like holier than thou kind of way. And this guy was a blast to hang out with. I mean, where I come from, church, people aren't exactly fun, you know? I mean, they're not exactly normal. They don't do anything normal. Well, anyway, you know how some people view lawyers and stuff, like they're all kind of liars and cheats? I mean, you guys insert your own jokes here. I mean, I'm sure we all know all the lawyer jokes, but it's the same way in the tax business. The people that you associate with on a regular basis are hardly considered high class. So it didn't surprise me a bit when this guy started catching a lot of flack for hanging out with and partying with the wrong crowd, you know, the liars and cheats, the people of such questionable character. Well, the moral majority just laid into this guy. And kept talking about these dinners that he was going to and these parties that he was hanging out at. Well, he just laid into them. And this one time, he just let him have it. He said, you know what? I'm here to help these people. You know, you don't send a doctor to people who aren't sick. And if it ain't broke. Well, I mean, that shut him up for a while. But it didn't last that long. They just kept railing this guy about and questioning him about these parties that he was hanging out at. And eventually he just started shrugging his shoulders and kind of laughing, saying, yeah, I was there. And it cracked me up because his attitude was almost as if his mere presence of being there was reason enough just to throw a party. And you know what? I got to agree with him on that one because people these days are taking their lives way too stinking serious. It's like they're living every day like it's some kind of funeral. You know, there's plenty of time down the road for funerals. And you'd think that these people would have quit. They would have just let up a little bit. But they didn't. They just stayed on this guy. And I think it was mostly because they just didn't get him. I mean, they didn't know what to say to him. And I'll tell you, it sure didn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that there was something about this guy that they were scared of. And to this day, my friend and I, we talk about this man. And you know, I think a lot of people still talk about that guy.
I've often wondered, what was it? What was it about Jesus hanging out with the wrong people that made him such a public enemy to some? I have one theory. I mean, I think it was a big piece of it. I think for those that were in power at the time, I think those that were kind of the religious establishment at the time, they fell prey to this kind of age-old choice that they felt when they encountered somebody who had done something wrong, when they encountered somebody who had made some bad choices, some unhealthy choices in their life, they felt they only had one of two options to respond to them. One of them is they could just say, hey, you know, that's okay. You do your thing and I do my thing. You know, kind of just anything goes, live and let live. Or they felt the only other option available to them was they could point out what they had done wrong and they could just kind of blast them and devalue them as a person and maybe guilt them into changing. Those are the two choices that they saw available to them. And you know what? I don't think those choices died out in Jesus' day. I think that that kind of dichotomy that there has to be, these are the only two choices we have, is a tradition that's been carried down very strongly to this very day of those who feel that those are the two choices we have. In his book, Shame, Salman Rushdie talks about how he feels that all the societies in the world basically swing on this pendulum from one generation to the next. You know, they swing on this pendulum. And at one end of the pendulum are those who say, hey, do whatever you want to do. Anything goes. And then on the other end of the pendulum, the other end of the spectrum is those who say, oh, no, you don't. And so this pendulum kind of swings from kind of like at one end, kind of think of the ACLU, and at the other end, kind of think of the religious right. And they feel those are the only two choices we have. But yet, when we see the life of Jesus, we see this thing that you might call the genius of the and. He didn't fall for this false either-or thinking, that I can give truth to somebody or I can give love to somebody, but I've got to choose which one. When we see the way he interacted with people, people who had made some really bad choices, we see that he interacted with them and basically said, hey, we can love someone and we can challenge them to change. We don't have to fall into this thing where we think life is about being in moments where we either administer grace or we administer truth. That there is grace and truth that comes together. We can love someone and not agree with the choices that they made. We can love someone and challenge them to change at the same time. It is not a question of grace or truth. The way we see Jesus did it, the way we see this public enemy did it, is that he loved people and challenged them to change. During these next 3 weeks, we're going to dig into some of these controversial scenes from the life of Jesus. Some of these things that made him such a public enemy to so many. And I realize that as we do this, we're not kind of painting on a blank slate here. We all have impressions and images and sound bites that we carry around about who Jesus was and what that does or does not mean to anything. I have them, and I can't say that all of them that I carry around with me are accurate. But one of the things I wonder is, as we sit in here today, is how many different of these impressions and images are we carrying around? And where are we kind of starting from when we take a look at scenes such as this and how this comes up against some of our images? So we want to ask you to help us a little bit as we move into the rest of this series. And we want to kind of get some of your impressions about what some of these images are that you carry around with you. And we want to kind of respond to those in some way during the rest of the series. So what I'd like you to do right now is, there's a blank piece of paper in your program. And you may have written on some of it already. That's all right. If you have, just kind of tear off whatever white space that you have, because I'm going to ask you to answer two questions for us and give it to us that we're going to use during the rest of this series as we think about where are we kind of moving from as we look at these images. So if you would, with whatever white space you have left, you want to tear it off, and on one side write the number one, and then on the other side write the number two, because there's two questions I'm going to ask you. The first one is, and let me summarize kind of these scenes from Jesus' life we just looked at here. Kind of the first one is this passage in the Bible where it talks about him coming into the temple where they were selling and buying and trading all these kind of things, and him getting ticked off about it and overturning the tables and throwing out all these people that were trying to make money in there. I would call that kind of Jesus challenging the establishment in a feisty way. You might want to just think of that as feisty Jesus. Doesn't kind of line up with kind of like the more Prozac Jesus we tend to see, you know, of the nice little kind of pictures in children's Bibles. Bibles and stuff. That would be feisty Jesus. That's the first scene. Now, as I describe each one of these scenes, what I want you to do is just on your piece of paper, write down the one in one word or collection of words, whatever you want to do. Write down the one that you most identify with, that most clicks with kind of some of the current images of who Jesus is that you have with him. Which one of these most fits easily with your current images of Jesus? So the first one, that's kind of feisty Jesus. The second one was this weird story where he encounters this crazy guy who's demon-possessed and casts the demon out of the guy into these pigs, and the pigs kind of run in the water and drown. Really weird stuff. I would just, for lack of a better term, call that weird Jesus, okay? I mean, just, man, how do we explain that? Just really strange. So the second one is just kind of strange. Strange things that we can't explain about him. The third one was when Jesus interacts with this woman and challenges her on some of the past relationships she's had and the five previous husbands she's had and the relationship she's having now, challenges her on these unhealthy choices that she's made in her life with relationships with men. That's the kind of Jesus that brings hard truth to somebody. So I kind of call that hard truth. Now the fourth one is this time when, you know, when one of many times where Jesus was hanging out with the wrong people. You know, and this time it was this tax collector who were kind of the lowest on the pecking order, you know, within that society. And Jesus not only hung out with him, he went to his parties and he partied with him. I would just kind of call that the wrong people. And then the last one was in Jesus' encounter this woman who was being accused by the religious leaders of having committed adultery, and apparently she had. And now Jesus doesn't respond within the typical choice that they tried to force him into, which is, hey, you can either say it's okay, or you can just kind of blast her and stone her. And yet he responded to her with love and truth and said, hey, anybody, whoever hasn't sinned here, you go ahead and pick up the first stone to stone her. And they all kind of walked away. But then at the end, he turned to her, he said, now go and sin no more. He brought her love and truth at the same time. So I would just call that love and truth at the same time. So of those five, which one of those, as you've seen them or I've just described them, which one of them most easily fits with some of the pictures that you carry around of who Jesus is right now? I'm going to give you about 15 seconds to go ahead and jot whatever thought you have down there next to number one on your piece of paper. And again, I'd kind of sum them up as Jesus that's feisty, Jesus that's strange, Jesus that delivers hard truth, Jesus that hangs out with the wrong people, and Jesus that delivers love and truth at the same time. Of those five, if you'd flip open your paper and write number two, what I'd like you to answer now is which one of those is hardest, is most difficult to sync up with the image of Jesus that you have? Which one of those goes most against kind of the sound bites of who he was you have in your head? Which one of those is toughest to match up with your current image? Take a few seconds and write that. You know, I know last week when some of us came down here and we wrote kind of what we thought our idols were and we kind of smashed them in those coffins kind of as a way to symbolize, hey man, I want to die to myself. Some of us, the initial reaction coming out of that was not all warm and fuzzy, because we found when we smashed our idols, we found that's all we had. And so our initial reaction was one of we felt very vulnerable and naked. I think that is the exact reaction we often have when we encounter who this real Jesus was. Maybe challenges us to wrestle with things we'd rather not. And our reaction is one of feeling rather vulnerable and a bit naked. You know, I cannot guarantee you that these next 3 weeks you're going to hear all things that you like. And I don't want to ask you to come in here every week and just automatically believe everything we tell you, or to even understand everything that we're talking about. What I do want to ask you to commit to over these next 3 weeks, though, is commit to being open and vulnerable to new truth and what that might mean. I talked this summer during one of the series that we did. I talked about these children's books. I try to read one of them to my kids every summer. The series of books C.S. Lewis wrote called The Chronicles of Narnia. It's a series of seven books, and it's about this mythical land of Narnia that these kids can enter by going through this magical closet. And in this world of Narnia, this mythical world of Narnia, it is ruled by this lion named Aslan. And C.S. Lewis wrote these books years and years ago with Aslan as the Christ figure of these stories that he was telling. And there's a scene very early on in one of the books where the children have gone through the magic closet and they're in Narnia. And I mentioned this summer, that there's this thing where they first start to hear about Aslan, and it's through Mr. Beaver. And Mr. Beaver is talking, he says, hey, whenever anybody first encounters Aslan, if their knees aren't shaking, well, they're either braver than most or they're just plain silly. And one of the little kids, Lucy, says, well, wait, are you saying he's not safe? Mr. Beaver says, safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he's not safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. I cannot guarantee you that this journey will be safe. I can guarantee you that it'll be good. Let's pray. God, I ask that for myself and for everyone in here, you keep us vulnerable and you keep us open to wrestling with truth about who you are. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, I remember when he used to come around and he'd tell us kids stories. The grown-ups would get all upset and say, get these kids out of here, they're just wasting your time. But he would smile at us, and he'd say it's okay. And then he'd put some of us on his lap and tell us about all the places he'd been to, the people he'd talked to, and the things that he'd done. But in the end, they killed him.
Suspect was last seen living.